ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Christopher Skase. Young, handsome, entrepreneur. He finds epic success in the 80s.
He came with that cowboy energy. He was doing big things.
Skase becomes a media mogul.
He outbid the legendary Rupert Murdoch.
His empire teeters, but he outfoxes them all. I'm Mark Humphreys. To binge the full series now, search for ABC Rewind and look for Skase, Fall of a Tycoon on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Now, no Bruce Shapiro in this show. He's watching the mayoral race in New York and will report in tomorrow, by which time, perhaps, Trump will have sent in the troops. On this show, the very earliest days of photography in Australia, and the handful of images that show us what life was like here in the 1840s and 1850s, a first history of the photography of that time has been written by Alyssa de Courcy. I'll be talking to her later. But first, in September 1961, under circumstances that have never really been explained, a plane carrying the Secretary-General of the United Nations, Dag Hammarskjöld, crashed in Zambia, killing everyone aboard. The Security Council chose as his successor an almost unknown Burmese diplomat who, in the 60s, became a mighty figure in the world. U Thant drove decolonization, challenged Washington over Vietnam, worked with great skill to contain conflicts from Kashmir to the Congo, and played a little-known but vital role in resolving the Cuban Missile Crisis. His grandson, Thant Mino, thought it was time to celebrate his grandfather, who's largely disappeared from history, hence the biography he has written, Peacemaker, U Thant and the Forgotten Quest for a Just World. Academic, historian, author of 5 books on the history of Burma, a man who has helped lead reform efforts in Myanmar, Thant Minh U joins me now from the UK. Welcome to Late Night Live.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Hey, I have to start with that photograph of you as a little boy in your grandfather's arms, flanked by Apollo 11 astronauts after their mission to the moon. What on earth was happening?
He was very keen on space exploration. So he met with all of the different, not just astronauts, but cosmonauts as well over those years. And I remember, I must have been 3 years old at the time, woken up to watch the moon landing in his bedroom on the big Zenith color TV. And this was many months later when the Apollo 11 astronauts came to the UN and came to see him. And they gave the UN a moon rock, which is still at the UN. And I don't remember meeting them per se, but I remember going to his office that day. I remember when that photo was taken, because the thing that impressed me the most were not the astronauts who had just come back from the moon, but the big map behind with blinking lights, which I was always attracted to as a four-year-old, I think, at the time.
Blinking lights are a winner every time, aren't they? Let's start with your grandfather's early life. He was born in what was known then as Burma.
Yeah, that's right. It was part of the British Empire. Burma was then a province of India, just like the Punjab or Bengal. He was from a well-to-do family that suddenly became impoverished when he was 15. So he had to give up all his hopes of finishing university. And instead, he decided after just a couple of years at university to quit and come back to this little town. It was university in Rangoon, which was a day's steamer ride away, to come back to this little town and to teach in the local school. And he became headmaster. And that way he was able to look after his younger brothers and his mother as well. And he stayed there until he was nearly 40 years old. He was really interested in the rest of the world. He was reading every book, magazine, newspaper he could get a hold of. He mastered English himself. But he was in this little town that was very remote, even by Burmese standards. And at nearly age 40, he decided to leave, midlife career change, went to Rangoon, joined government service, and within 10 years, he found himself living in Midtown Manhattan as Burma's new ambassador to the UN.
Doug Hammarskjöld was a huge figure. How did this obscure man from Burma come to succeed him?
Yeah, you know, because the UN, it was set up originally in 1945. It was meant to be this, you know, five policemen of the world, the US, the Russians, the British, they were all going to work together. And it didn't happen because of the Cold War. And the UN was kind of stuck for a few years in a way. And it was Dag Hammarskjöld who pioneered this idea of the UN Secretary General being the world's mediator and solving conflicts. And something else that was happening at the same time was that many countries, dozens of countries in Asia and Africa were becoming independent. They called themselves the Afro-Asians of the UN. They were becoming the biggest bloc of countries at the UN by 1961. And at the height of the Cold War, you know, with the Americans and the Soviets facing off in Berlin and this crisis in the Congo, they decided we can't leave everything in the hands of just Washington and Moscow. We have to take the helm of the UN. We have to have one of our own at the helm of the UN. And they pushed people like Nehru in India and Nkrumah in Ghana for an Afro-Asian candidate. And Burma was at that time a neutral country, so that was helpful. And my grandfather, over those few years since he arrived in New York, had developed a reputation as a skillful diplomat and someone who just got on with everyone. And so I think that pushed him over the line in terms of getting support from the Americans as well as the Afro-Asians, countries like Sweden and Ireland. The Russians were not too sure about him. They didn't really know. But they agreed in the end. But because of the Russians, he was on probation for the first year as acting Secretary General.
But the French thought he was too short.
Yeah, he was 5'7", almost 5'8", which wasn't actually very short in those days, about the same as people like, say, Harold Wilson in Britain. But yeah, they said they were musing amongst themselves that maybe he was too short. And more importantly for them, he didn't speak French at all. And he replied to the journalist who mentioned this that he was taller than Napoleon, who didn't even speak English.
What did it mean that he was a Buddhist?
Buddhism was very important to him, but it was also quite a personal thing. So it meant less. I mean, in New York, he couldn't be involved in any Buddhist ceremonies or anything like that, going to monasteries or pagodas, things that he might have done in Burma with family. It was more of a personal sort of view of the world. And I think he really valued above anything else sort of calm-headedness, people who stayed calm under pressure, who had a grip on their own sort of inner thoughts and feelings and emotions. It was a kind of a stoicism in a way. It also gave him a very sort of ethical view of the world. And it was always a work in progress. I think he always tried really hard under very difficult circumstances over those years to try to improve his Buddhism, his sense, you know, these kind of Buddhist ideas that all things are impermanent, that life is about change, that you have to be tolerant. All these things, I think, were things that he and my grandmother, who is in some ways even a more devout Buddhist, constantly reminded him about. He saw his role more as, you know, the person who had to be available to fix things and try things quietly from behind the scenes first. And it was only reluctantly that he, you know, goes forward and does these things like challenge Lyndon Johnson on Vietnam.
Yes, you don't do that lightly.
No, but he got away with it, which is the amazing thing, right? He got away with it. Imagine now, you know, future UN Secretary General standing up and basically, you know, condemning Donald Trump or something. He wouldn't last 5 minutes in that job.
It'll come. It'll come. How did the United Nations change as all of these former colonies became states and became members of the UN?
Yeah, they were already beginning to transform the UN because they embraced the charter. They actually gave meaning to the human rights aspects of the charter and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. They had come out of decades of fighting colonialism. They wanted to make anti-racism a very important thing at the UN. They wanted to complete decolonization. And they wanted to complete decolonization in a way that independence was genuine and real. It wasn't just a piece of paper that London or Paris or the British or the French would give them, but that it meant that they were part of an international system in which they were treated equally to the Europeans, the Americans, and the others. And I think U Thant felt the same way, and he would lead this fight for decolonization. And one of the first things he did, the thing that changed, and the thing that was very different from Hammarskjöld was Hammarskjöld in the Congo, which is a very complex crisis, but it was essentially about kind of independence and what that meant. Hammarskjöld was looking for a compromise, and he died actually trying to find a ceasefire or negotiate a ceasefire. But U Thant took a much tougher line in support of the Congo government and against this breakaway province that was being assisted by the, propped up by the Belgians and by white supremacist networks in southern Africa. So he took a much tougher line and actually unleashed or wanted to unleash the UN peacekeeping force there against to fight the mercenaries that had come in from South Africa and elsewhere.
Is that what happened in the end? Was that how that hideous situation was resolved?
Yeah, absolutely. So he had trouble in the beginning because the British were trying to hold him back. The British were, the Conservative government or members of the of Conservative MPs were actually, many of them were shareholders in the mining companies that were going to do well in this breakaway province. So the government of Harold Macmillan was trying to hold him back. And he spent many months trying to get around this European pressure by building up good relations with Kennedy as well as with Khrushchev, who was the Soviet leader. And in 63, he did give a green light to what was called Operation Grand Slam, where several thousand UN troops, the first and only real UN army under a UN Secretary General with its own air force. They were Swedes, Irishmen, Ghanaians, Indians, with a big Indian armored brigade at the center, took on thousands of South African, British, Rhodesian, French, Belgian, white supremacist mercenaries and defeated them. And that was the end of the Congo secession in 1963.
By that time, though, your grandfather had played an important but I found fascinating role in the Cuban Missile Crisis. Now, what was he doing there? What was it that he managed to pull off?
I think the traditional, you know, what people learn in schools or might have seen in a movie is that the Russians put nuclear or the Russians put missiles in Cuba and Kennedy blockades the island. Soviet ships are still coming towards the blockade line. The world is on the brink of a nuclear war. And somehow, because the Americans stand tough, the Russians back down. That's kind of the story that we...
Yeah,
we
that's the standard explanation. The standard. Kennedy held firm.
Yeah, exactly. And what none of these stories mention is that there was a Burmese UN Secretary General who was the mediator that made the de-escalation of the crisis possible. And so he sent a series, and people will see in the book, it's a really complicated story with late night phone calls from the White House to him and everything else, sent a series of both public messages and secret communications that essentially understood that this was a political crisis, not a military crisis. And he had to find or do the dance at the UN that he had to do, find a way to give Khrushchev and Kennedy the political space and the time they needed to climb down in their own ways and satisfy their own constituencies. So it's with Khrushchev, for example, it was much easier to respond positively to an appeal for peace from a UN Secretary General than it was to respond to an ultimatum from an American president. For Kennedy as well, he saw many different ways in which U Thant's diplomacy was useful. And at one stage in the crisis, U Thant was had both senior U.S. and Soviet delegations just outside his office on the 38th floor of the U.N. in different rooms, shuttling between the two to try to hammer out a verification agreement once the overall framework of which was his idea in the beginning, of trading the removal of Soviet missiles for an American pledge not to invade Cuba had already been more or less agreed. He also flew to Havana in the middle of the crisis to placate Fidel Castro, who still at that point could have done many things to tip the crisis over into war. And he spent a couple of days with Fidel.
Did those three leaders, Castro, Khrushchev, Kennedy, acknowledge his role?
Yeah, because, you know, when I started working on this, I thought, you know, it's kind of a forgotten thing. I was looking in the archives, saw lots of things that had never been written up, even in sort of scholarly works or very, very little. And I thought maybe I'm over, you know, thinking about this or seeing things that it's not there. And I looked at the newspapers at that time, and he was on the front page every single day. So the New York Times, he was in the headline, Kennedy accepts Thant's plan, you know, Thant about to fly to Cuba, all these things. And so it wasn't, I mean, his role was acknowledged at the time. And at the end of the Cuban Missile Crisis, I think for the first and probably last time, the US and Soviet governments both together signed a letter of appreciation. And Kennedy in public said, Uthant has put the world in his debt because of what he did to de-escalate the Cuban Missile Crisis.
What was he able to do about atomic testing? This, I gather, you know, from what you write, he detested the bomb.
Yeah, he was pretty fervent in his belief that it was crazy for the world to have nuclear weapons because it was just going to be a matter of time before they were going to be used again. And it wasn't just him. The Afro-Asians, the non-aligned countries were also, had been pushing very hard for disarmament. That was at the top of the UN agenda. And it was in that context that the Americans and the Soviets negotiated the first non-proliferation or nuclear test ban treaty. It was a nuclear test ban treaty in 1964. And he went to the signing with Khrushchev and others in Moscow in the summer of that year. But he continued to talk a lot about the danger of nuclear war. And he was particularly worried, I think, through the 60s that the Americans would be tempted to use nuclear weapons in Vietnam in the same way that they had been tempted to use them in Korea a decade before.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I am talking to Thant Minh U, the grandson of U Thant, the first non-Western UN Secretary General. He prided himself on not being a radical, and yet everything about his sort of bigger political ambitions suggests a man who was indeed radical.
He was radical in many ways. And he said to the Americans, actually, in the early 60s, I think it was, that they shouldn't be afraid of radical change in Asia. He was an anti-communist at home, so he had no desire to see, you know, communist governments come to power in Asia. But by radical, I think he meant that these countries in Asia and Africa, the newly independent countries, wanted radical change. They wanted to develop. They wanted to catch up with the West. They wanted social progress. They wanted change from you know, the state of their societies under colonial rule. So he was radical in that way. And then I think he thought, in the same way that many others, I think, who had founded the UN believed as well, that after two world wars, 80 million people dead, a Great Depression in between, atomic weapons in the, you know, hundreds or thousands by that time in the hands of the Soviets and the Americans, that there had to be a completely different vision of international politics, that we just couldn't go back to the, you know, look back to the 19th century, early 20th century for ideas. We had to make a different international system that was based on the UN Charter. I think he believed that, and I think he understood that that would take radical change, not just in terms of specific policies, but in terms of how people thought about the world at the time as well, and their places as not just citizens of, you know, patriots, American patriots, Russian patriots, citizens of different countries, but also as people living on this planet. And that, you know, we also had to have this sort of shared sense that the planet needed protecting as well in many different ways.
Do we look at his efforts around the Vietnam War as really a failure on his part to achieve anything worthwhile?
It was a failure of the UN in a way, because one could say that a lot of things that were happening in Vietnam were violations of the UN Charter. He had no mandate, so the Security Council, which should have or could have perhaps acted, didn't. And without a mandate, the Secretary General is essentially sort of powerless. He just has a sort of moral authority. But despite that, for many, many years, he tried tirelessly to try to find a way out for the Americans, essentially. And that included, as people see my book, you know, sort of secret diplomacy between the North Vietnamese and the Americans, or attempts at that. And also, increasingly, publicly challenging the American way of thinking about Vietnam. And this is what really upset people like President Lyndon Johnson, with whom he had a very strange relationship. Because he was saying to the Americans, look, this is not about domino theory, is a fiction. This is not about the Chinese taking over Vietnam. The Vietnamese have no desire to be under the Chinese or anybody else. They just want to be on their own two feet. They want their country reunified. The more this can be done in a negotiated way, the better the chance that the South Vietnamese will escape communism, or at least, you know, the harsher types of communism that could come to the country. And a peacefully reunified Vietnam is not a threat to anyone. and you can use me and I can help you in trying to make that happen. So this is what he was saying. He said the Vietnamese feel that they're in a fight for independence, first against the French and then against the Americans. And if the Americans try for a military solution, and he said this as early as 63, 64, they will lose. And he said to the Americans privately, you will lose this war and it will be a disaster for Americans and it will be a disaster for the world. Because if we go back to that time in 64, he had just mediated the Cuban Missile Crisis. The UN was flying high. The Soviets had kind of mellowed out under Khrushchev. They and the Americans under Kennedy and even Johnson early on wanted to work with the UN. He thought many things were going to be possible in terms of development, all kinds of cooperation. And then Vietnam happened. So I think he knew from the beginning that an American war in Vietnam would be not just in terms of the countless kind of, you know, people dying, being killed, all the atrocities that happened, but that it was going to be a disaster for global peace.
And all this time, he was, in a way, inventing the role of the Secretary General. That it was, as you mentioned a moment ago, it was not an office that had any particular power to it, except what he could bring to it.
That's exactly right. So the charter just says Secretary General is the head of the organization, and the only power it gives him in or her, maybe in the future, under Article 99, is this person can bring to the attention of the Security Council anything that he thinks might be a threat to international peace and security. And so implicit in that is that he has some role. He's not just the kind of manager of the office that organizes the conferences and things, that he has some kind of political role. And it's based on that Hammarskjöld first and then U Thant over 10 years really tried to develop that political role of the Secretary General. But in the end, he has no specific power. Again, it's the moral authority of the office and his ability to constantly develop and maintain also relationships with the top leader. So in a way that we don't see anymore, and we haven't for a long time, he would see, you know, the Soviet leader like Brezhnev one day, Charles de Gaulle the next day, hop over to London and see Harold Wilson, go back to America and see Lyndon Johnson. And he was in touch with dozens of other leaders from around the world. So on any issue, I think he had to develop, and this was his kind of superpower, in a sense of empathy, you know, a sense of what everyone was thinking and where the openings might be for diplomacy and for a UN role on any potential threat. I mean, not just Vietnam, but on any potential issue that was facing the organization.
And it depended on trust.
It depended on an ability of, well, two things. One is, I think, on the leaders of these governments to believe that the UN was not just this kind of idealistic set of abstract ideas, let's all work together and hope for the best, but a really practical machine, right? A machine where of U Thant and senior diplomats around him that were working for him, really some of the top mediators in the world, that they could help to find a solution if there was a problem in a conflict in crisis in Cyprus, a conflict in Kashmir, a conflict between the Dutch and the Indonesians over Papua, anything it was, anything that there might have been, that there was this UN machinery that they could turn to. I think they had to have certain confidence in that. But I think U Thant and his lieutenants also had to constantly prove themselves by actually delivering and bringing about different ceasefires and then building on those successes to try to use this growing kind of UN authority in different ways as well.
What languages did he speak?
Only Burmese and English. So Burmese is his mother tongue, but his dad was an interesting figure, and he was a businessman. He was educated partly in Calcutta in India, and he had a Victorian library, of Victorian Edwardian books at home. So my grandfather learned some English at school, but then mastered English himself. He didn't speak any other language. By reading Dickens and Arthur Conan Doyle and all kinds of different books as a little kid, 8, 9, 10 years old. Yeah.
He fell out rather with the Brits and the Americans towards the end of his time as Secretary General. What was that about?
It was Vietnam. It was Vietnam. I mean, I think we have to, you know, go back to that time. And Vietnam was the central, other than kind of overall U.S.-Soviet relations, but that had been kind of improving. Vietnam was the central issue, right? And it was the American central national security issue. And he challenged that. as this person who, you know, from Burma, and he had fallen out with the Burmese government as well. He was just this lone guy on the 38th floor at the top of the UN building, challenging the whole US national security establishment on its war in Vietnam. And I think the British, for different reasons, didn't want to, we see this in different times in British history, didn't want to go up against the Americans on what was their big issue. So they also had a feeling that U Thant was being soft on the communist side. And I think they made themselves feel that way to some extent because they wanted to please the Americans at that time.
But Thant, at least the British stayed out of the fighting. The Australians went, dived in our way. We like to join America in its wars. Can it be said that U Thant did any particular good for Australia?
That's a good question, because Australia was, you know, really important in the founding of the UN. It was one of the countries that really pushed for the idea that it shouldn't just be about the big powers, but that small states should also have a role and try to make the role of the General Assembly, where every country has a representative and an equal vote, bigger. And Australia, has a big contribution to peacekeeping as well. But I think the UN's role for Australia is something different, which is, you know, I think we have to understand that the UN in the 50s, 60s, 70s was essential in creating the international system that we have today. The international system that we have today wasn't just sort of thought up by a couple of, you know, few Americans and Brits and Russians. It was the result of these fights by a lot of these countries to have this more equitable system, to infuse it with all these ideas in the UN Charter. And it's been imperfect. There have been lots of UN failures as well as successes. But, you know, its central aim by far, its central aim was to prevent World War III. And we haven't had World War III since 1945. And I think you look at the UN, it's a bit like, you know, in a house you have this old wall and it looks damaged and doesn't look so great anymore. But it's a load-bearing wall. And so much else that we have in the international system that has made the last many decades of peace and prosperity possible is because of the UN, I think. And not just as a piece of paper, but as, you know, the result of these efforts over those initial decades to make it something meaningful.
There's another photograph in the book, your grandfather's retirement party, and some extraordinary guests.
Yeah, he was retiring at the end of 1971, and there was a big party thrown for him. It was a luncheon at the Pierre Hotel in New York. It was a cold, sort of rainy day. And 600 people, many of the usual suspects, diplomats, UN officials, but also all these celebrities, people who had fundraised for the party, including people like Jackie Kennedy. It included all these top business people from places like Chase Manhattan Bank, but also groups like the Amalgamated Laundry Workers of New York, showing you that the trades unions were also really important in supporting the UN at the time. But all these celebrities like Buckminster Fuller, Arnold Toynbee, Joan Baez, Cesar Chavez, they had all written in with these messages. And at the party itself, there were all these celebrities as well, like Jacques Cousteau, for example. And Pete Seeger was meant to sing the music for the party. So U Thant gives this big speech. He says, we all need to be thinking of ourselves as planetary citizens. They all declare him planetary citizen number one. And John Lennon's there with Yoko Ono. He passes Pete Seeger a little note. Pete Seeger gives John Lennon a guitar. And John Lennon says, you know, you wouldn't have heard this song before because I've never sung it in the US. And he sings Imagine for the first time in America.
Thant, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
I've been talking to Thant Minh U, who has written A Life of His Grandfather, the great leader of the United Nations, U Thant. The book is called Peacemaker, U Thant and the Forgotten Quest for a Just World, published by Norton. Coming up, the earliest photographs of Australia, what they can tell us and what they can't. May 1841, the first camera arrived in Australia. How and why it got here is a story we'll explore in a moment, but right from the beginning, This miraculous new technology was put to work in the colonial project, promoting the country, its settlement, its land and its people, white and black, savage and civilized. Cameras in those very early years recorded the world with an accuracy people had never known before. And the images that survive, my next guest writes, are more than delicate artifacts. They have great historical power. The stories they tell persist. Elisa De Corsi is a curator, historian and author of a new book, Early Photography in Colonial Australia, published by Melbourne University Press. Elisa joins me from Canberra. Elisa, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, David. I'm delighted to be here.
Tell us the story of that first camera and how it reached Australia.
Oh, well, it's a rollicking tale, really, and one without a lot of design. So as most listeners will probably know, the invention of photography is not something that happened in Australia. It happened in France and Britain, and it's a series of kind of discoveries and experimentations, processes of experimentation that are refined and then patented and then commercialized. And these happen in the late 1830s. Around 1839, there's a commercial unveiling of a process called the daguerreotype, which is the first real kind of photographic process that has commercial uptake. And a camera leaves France on an educational vessel, actually, an Ecolier Flottante, which is an expedition chartered by a person called Captain Augustine Lucas. And he is in charge of taking a crew of essentially upper middle class pupils around the world with a ship full of teachers and maritime professionals as a form of, I guess, enlightenment education. And aware of the discussions about photography happening in France, Captain Lucas visits the French inventor of photography, Louis-Jacques Mordeguer's studio in Paris. And along with ecclesiastical tutor Louis Comte, he acquires a camera, plates and chemistry. Now, this is kind of a very long story, but essentially the vessels he's on, L'Orient, leaves France just as the big unveiling of photography is happening in France, and it sails down the African coast, crosses the Atlantic, and pictures are kind of taken along the way. It progresses further south, down the South American coast, and then it's up to the harbour at Valparaiso in Chile in June 1840, and it's scheduled to keep on going up the American West coastline before crossing the Pacific and heading to the Philippines. But there's a big shipwreck when it leaves Valparaiso Harbour on the 23rd of June 1840, and this whole expedition, which I should say at this point has had international attention in the press, is disbanded, and it's kind of comes to a terminal end in Valparaiso when the ship runs aground while leaving the harbour and kind of crashes on the escarpment of the lighthouse. But what happens then is that Captain Lucas, with the daguerreotype camera and the remaining plates and the chemistry, is forced to think about how he gets himself back to France. And he is part of a maritime family, and he has a brother who's a merchant captain on another ship. And it's on this ship, the Justine, that is shuttling across the Pacific, that Lucas brings the camera and the plates into Wawaran, Sydney Harbour in March 1841. So it's really an accident.
No, it's a series of disasters.
Yes, it's definitely. Well, but I mean, I call it quite traumatic, but that shipwreck in terms of 19th century shipwrecks is, you know, everyone escapes with their life. I mean, the plates are intact, the camera's intact.
It's a very civilized shipwreck.
Yeah.
And it brings us the camera. And what is the response of Sydney to the arrival of this camera?
Well,
wonder, enthusiasm, excitement?
Oh, gosh. Well, I have a whole chapter that I call Arrivals because I feel like this is one contender for the arrival of photography in colonial Australia, but it's definitely not the only one. And I think the thing about Lucas's expedition is that really news of his shipwreck and news of the school vessel being run aground in Valparaiso actually makes its way to Sydney before Lucas and the camera does. So people know that the L'Oriental has been shipwrecked in Valparaiso, and it's the hype around this expedition that kind of translated across the news in the British and French worlds, and then its kind of unglamorous end, which precedes Lucas. So he arrives somewhat shamed, I think that's fair to say. And the camera is kind of like incidental. And I think this is important to know, that in 1841, in March, people are hearing about photography in colonial Australia.
They hadn't seen anything.
No. So there is no record of a photographic image arriving before this camera. There's no opportunity to have a picture taken. And I think it is very hard for people to understand, to have the language to understand what photography is. So the camera is set up for a demonstration. And I think this is such a poetic moment. The journalist who comes to cover the event calls the issuing picture a beautiful and minute sketch, because there is no language to talk about that kind of indexical fidelity of the photographic image. There's no vocabulary to describe it yet.
Elisa, what was it of? What was the photograph of?
Yes. Well, the demonstration of the camera is set up outside a merchant storehouse, and Lucas is actually trying to sell the camera because he needs to pay for his passage back to France. And he's not having any luck selling the camera as an inert object, so he sets up this idea of a demonstration. And it is of the streetscape at Macquarie Place. But we don't have the photograph. We only have accounts of the photograph being taken. There is no surviving picture, and the camera remains unsold. So when I talk about this event in the context of the book, I really use it to kind of describe a false start in the practice of colonial photography, because we have a camera, we have someone who might know how to use it, but we have a description of an image that doesn't survive and definitely doesn't have any publicity around it after that event. It's not put in someone's shop window, it's not taken by someone, it's not of someone. So it kind of disappears, and that camera remains unsold for 3 years. So it's an arrival of a technology, but not the beginning of a practice.
There's something terribly Australian about that.
Yeah, well, I guess what I try and discuss is that, you know, all these things are being engineered in, Europe. So photography is foreign, and it relies on the kind of confluence of a number of different things. You have to have the technical skill to take a picture. Then you need the equipment, but then you need it also to kind of be cared for and looked after somewhere for the image to survive. So it's only really when those three things align and people start using photography in a purposeful way that you get a practice coalescing.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I am talking to Elisa De Corsi about her book, Early Photography in Colonial Australia, which has just appeared, published by Melbourne University Press. Elisa, what's the earliest photograph we have taken on the Australian continent?
Oh, surviving today, you mean? In
That's what I mean by surviving. Now.
Oh, it is such a tricky question. You want to see it? Well, it's one that gets trundled out a lot. It's of William Bland, and it comes from the first commercial studio run by George Baron Goodman, and it is in Sydney, and it's from 1845. So it's, it's almost 4 years after that camera demonstration we were just talking about. But I think if I could just like take a beat at that point, this book that I've written and researched is the first kind of substantial study of early photography in colonial Australia, a two-decade period from the 1840s to the 1860s. And I think why this period hasn't received a lot of attention more broadly is because the quantity of images that we have from it is so small. But we have a whole lot of other source material which tells us about the kind of bulk of images that were being produced. So I'm going to talk about William Bland's photograph, which is in the State Library of New South Wales, and they routinely bring it out for exhibition. And it's this kind of
And I've point. Got it. I've got it in front of me now. It's on page 30 in your book. Yes.
But so Goodman, the photographer, had an almost decade-long practice in colonial Australia, and we have a dozen less than a dozen images from his commercial studio surviving in Australian collections. But we know he made thousands of photographs. And we know this because we look at things like when he spent 4 months in Melbourne, the papers recorded how much money he made. And that was £870 in 4 months. Now, his daguerreotypes, a six-plate daguerreotype was £1, one shilling. So you can imagine how the bulk of photographs that are produced in this period are not equivalent to what we have surviving today.
Oh, but at least they're there. They're out there somewhere. They're in a box somewhere. They are in somebody's cupboard. They don't know what they are and how valuable they are. They are going to turn up, I know. I'm completely confident they have to.
Yeah, I mean, I think it points to a few things. It points to how people used photographs in the colony, and those people who could afford to commission portraits often sent them away overseas. So one of the great writers of Australian photography, Helen Ennis, says it might be just as possible to do a project like this in England or Scotland or Ireland because there'll be lots of Australian photographs there. But the other point is, and I was actually just talking about this with Helen this morning, the other point is like how to find them. And lots of these images, you know, they don't have really obvious traces with them unless you read them as part of like next to letters and diaries. So you've got to recontextualize them in the kind of worlds of colonial image making they're a part of. And that's really what this book is about.
Tell people who Helen Ennis is because she matters.
Oh, Helen. She's written very widely about the history of photography. She's a biographer, and I guess she wrote in the early 2010s that, you know, this is the big gap in Australian photographic history, that no one's really written a substantial history of photography's arrival. And so in a kind of...
You've done the job.
Well, I've done the first go.
You've done the job. Alisa, can I say about the photograph of Dr. William Bland? It's a completely modern face. And that's what I find so moving about early photography. The moment you get this detailed perfection, the face is modern. That man could have wandered in off the street today.
I mean, that is the beauty, like the material beauty of the daguerreotype process is that it really is so sensitive to light that it's really capturing that very minute detail, detailed and minute sketch, like the reporter called it. But it's, you know, you can zoom in on these pictures, and in a lot of the images reproduced in the book, I actually include sections. So the photograph of William Bland, you know, it is a tiny image. It's meant to be held in the palm of your hand. It's small. But then the detail, the richness of detail in the image, if you look at the pupils in his eyes, you can see the window of the room reflected back in them. And I think this is actually something that you can't really see to the naked eye. But if you see a detailed digital image of the William Bland daguerreotype, you can then zoom in to the detail of his pupils. And I think that's an incredible kind of, you know, the detail has to be there in the historic image for you to see it, but it is definitely part of the research process that's enabled in the contemporary space.
People were photographed, but also landscape. Why was landscape photographed?
Oh, I mean, I think the real reason that this book is called Colonial Photography is because you can't have photography in this place if you don't re-embed it in the colonial history. In, you know, the camera arrives in 1841, as we talked about, the year after transportation ends, and the whole structure of society and politics in colonial Australia is shifting away from this narrative of penal settlement to colonial society and society by conquest. And photography is kind of actually really co-opted in a very obvious way to celebrate that conquest. So it chronicles the construction of cities, towns. I mean, the first outdoor photographs are taken on the steps of studios looking out, and they're on main streets, high streets, and it's a celebration of we are building cities here. And it's a kind of redaction of country. So it's a redaction of the narratives of country that are willfully denied. And then as technologies improve, you have this marriage with urban photography and kind of photography of the quote-unquote wilderness or outer reaches of the urban space, where it is about kind of exploration or like capturing the natural world and celebrating that kind of quote-unquote untouched beauty. So it's really
about... And celebrating the possibilities of putting sheep into that country.
Definitely. It's about economic resources, timber. I mean, this is not unique to photography, of course. You know, other colonial artists are doing this. If we think of Eugène von Gérard's big albums of, you know, the kind of untapped resources throughout the colony of Victoria, you know, there are... But photography kind of brings to it a kind of index. And I think the colonial landscape or the colonizing potential of the landscape really is emphasized when photographs enter the exhibition circuit, so the imperial exhibition circuit. So you have like hunks of timber or nuggets of gold next to the land, photographs of the land where those resources came from. So it's absolutely intertwined with processes of, colonizing and conquest.
When were the first images of Indigenous people?
Yeah. I guess the first images of Indigenous people we have surviving today come from the studios of William Kilburn, and they are people, Kulin people who have been brought to the studios to have their photographs taken. But I think this is a really interesting and valuable period in kind of critically studying the history of photography, these decades of the 1840s and the 1850s, because it's just on the threshold of when photography is co-opted into the missionary enterprise. And all those uses of photography to articulate or to show civilizing potential or civilizing success, as it was discussed, it is before that. And I think there are slipperinesses in how First Nations people are photographed. And in the book I write about a particular encounter with the camera that Menang Noongar people had, which is people in Albany in the southwesterly corner of the Australian continent, and think about the kind of value of those images today. In 1858, a survey ship docked in Mamankaroot, King George's Sound, and it had two photographers on board, Arthur Onslow and James Glenn Wilson. And in 1858, so that's like, you know, a decade and a half after that camera was demonstrated in Sydney, this is the first engagement of Menang Noongar people with photographic technologies. But, I went to Mananggaroot and I talked with Menang people, and we looked at these photographs of ancestors. And what's really striking is that the engagement with the camera is set up, the survey ship, the Herald, which was docked in the Sound, had two photographers, like I mentioned, and it's firstly colonists who come and have their pictures taken by the photographers.
Yeah.
And we have the account of this in the diaries of colonists. And then... the Menang are given small payments and they pose for the camera. And they do this in traditional dress. And I was talking about these, you know, what we can read from these images today, the value of these images today with the Menang people. And they have a seasonal and cultural legibility that wasn't captured at the time in the kind of letters and colonial archive. The Menang men are wearing bukas, which show the ant trails of the flesh eaten away by the stretched kangaroo skin. So a buka is a stretched kangaroo cloak. and Mamang wear the cloak with the fur side against their skin because it's quite blustery. And this is a practice of making bukas that happens in the high summer because the skins get stretched and they're out in the sun. And so the register of the ant trails on the outward-facing side of the kangaroo skins tells us something about what time of year these photographs are taken. But what's really fascinating to me is that the Mamang experience of photography isn't informed by, you know, hearing about photographic lectures or receiving photographs in the post or, you know, watching an earlier camera demonstration. It's informed by over two decades prior to the invention of photography about European explorers and colonists docking in Mamang-Karoot, King George's Sound, and the practices of cultural introduction that accompanied that. So what is happening in front of the camera is a display of cultural introduction. They have
because one of the figures, one of the figures is dressed in a European suit.
One of the figures, yes, is dressed in European suit.
But now look, we're going to fly from Mamang because we've only got a second left, I'm afraid. There was another genre which I think still fascinates us very much today from early photography. The photograph of the captured criminal.
Okay, yes.
They're so powerful. Why were captured criminals photographed? You know, the cornered, the bush ranger in the cell. Why was it important for us to have those images?
Yeah, well, I guess bush ranging is, it kind of shows the unwieldy and unpoliceability of the colonial frontier and the danger. And I guess photography acted as an element of surveillance in those spaces. Even though, you know, photographs aren't being taken of bushrangers in the midst of heists, it is this idea to identify the bushranger.
And to show that we've captured him.
And to celebrate the police work around the capture. But I think that often backfires, as I write about Ben Hall. I mean, when the public is presented with Ben Hall's image, they think of him as the gentleman bushranger because he is photographed in the studio and he looks very gentlemanly because he has commissioned this portrait and it is the only picture that the police have access to. So they seize the photograph of Ben Hall from his own house, which he's commissioned, and they use it in their kind of, in their activities of surveillance. But they're using a studio picture, which is already conditioned as a middle class entity.
He looks handsome. He looks beautiful. And when you see that photograph, well, certainly this was true for me, when I saw the photograph again in your book, I realise I've known that photograph all my life. It's one of the really sort of fundamental images of Australia.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, like, in the end, it's photography is part of the legend of violence around bushranging. I mean, I also talk about, you know, there's, you know, post-mortem photographs of bushrangers, and I don't really illustrate the book very much with those because I feel that's a bit ghoulish.
Oh, no, don't be squeamish.
But that idea of capture and demise and death is so pertinent to 19th century photography in so many ways.
Now, Elisa, I blame you for this. You mentioned in the end, you used the expression in the end, and we've reached the end. I'm so sorry. The time has run out. Thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
I've been talking to Elisa de Courcy, historian and curator at the Australian National University, about her new book, Early Photography in Colonial Australia. Now, look, it's not a great big picture book. It's not something to leave open on your coffee table. It's a book of thoughtful text and beautiful photographs, published by Melbourne University Press. This is Late Night Live. And that's the show. On our next, Bruce Shapiro will report in on the New York mayoral race. And while we're celebrating winners, we're talking to an American novelist who took on the AI giant that stole her work. And she won. Plus, Trump's decor and what it says about the state of populist politics today. Thank you.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.